Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. My name is Lauren Litton. I am the host of Spotlight on Youth, a radio show dedicated to social and legal trends impacting the rights and well-being of children across the country. Spotlight on Youth is a project of Children's Law Center, Inc., a not-for-profit children's rights legal services organization. The show is being streamed live over the Internet and will be available on demand after its conclusion. We encourage you to participate by asking our guests questions live on air by dialing 347-994-1149. The number again is 347-994-1149. And to indicate you have a question, you're going to press the number 1 on your telephone keypad and you'll be placed in a queue. Also, feel free to log into the chat room and pose a question there. During the 90s, we saw the creation of harsher laws and punishments for kids in juvenile court. Additionally, states lowered the age at which children could be tried in adult criminal court and expanded the range of young offenders subject to adult prosecution and punishment. The justice system was ill-prepared to respond to the structure set up in the 90s, and as a society, we are continuing to learn that the results for communities and youth have been expensive, ineffective, and even harmful. In the legal realm, due process issues are being raised with more frequency, one such issue being that of competency. Simply put, competency is an individual's ability to comprehend and participate in legal proceedings. In cases involving youth, not only is mental illness, intellectual, and behavioral disabilities taken into account, but so should developmental immaturity. Across the country, attorneys, judges, and mental health evaluators often find themselves with no legal framework to follow or under the guidance of archaic statutes created with an adult lens. States have been working to address this problem. Today's guests are going to discuss the importance of creating standards around juvenile competency and share trends across the country. Our guests are Dr. Kimberly Larson, who is currently an assistant professor in the Psychiatry Department of University of Massachusetts Medical School, where she is part of the Law and Psychiatry Program and the Center for Mental Health Services Research. Kim's research focuses on juvenile psychological development capacities in legal contexts. As part of the National Youth Screening and Assessment Project, she co-authored the manual Developing Statutes for Competence to Stand Trial in Juvenile Delinquency Proceedings, a Guide for Lawmakers. Kim received her law degree from Villanova University, her doctorate in clinical psychology from Drexel University, and completed her postdoctoral fellowship in forensic psychology at UMass Medical School's Law and Psychiatry Program. Doug Althauser is an attorney currently in private practice. He worked in the fields of mental health and chemical dependency for more than 20 years before going to law school. He holds licensure in Ohio as an attorney and as an independent chemical dependency counselor and is nationally certified as a rehabilitation counselor. Doug was instrumental in Ohio's effort to create a competency statute. He led the team of professionals and stakeholders who drafted the proposal that eventually became Ohio's juvenile competency law in 2001. Doug received his master's in rehabilitation counseling from Ohio University and his Juris Doctor from Capital University Law School. And Tegan is an attorney and senior policy specialist in the Transportation Criminal Justice Program at the National Conference of State Legislatures, or NCSL. NCSL is a nonprofit bipartisan organization regarded as the nation's leading authority on state legislative issues. And works on issues related to juvenile justice, including court jurisdiction, direct file laws, and competency. Prior to her current position, Anne was an intern for 2 years at the Kansas State Legislature. She received her bachelor's in sociology from Colorado State University and her Juris Doctorate from the University of Kansas School of Law. So I'd like to welcome the three of you to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lauren.
So I really would like to delve into what is competency. I went over it a little briefly, but I'm sure people are actually surprised that this is even an issue, that this hasn't been resolved before. So why is it coming up now? Why should we care about it? And what should we know? Who would like to start us off?
A series of questions.
Yeah, I know. Very easy, Doug. Why don't you take them?
I'll take the first swing at it. How about that?
Okay.
The issue of competency is a concept, a legal concept that goes back centuries into English common law, basically the idea was that in the same way that it was usually inappropriate to try a person in absentia, that is, if the individual if the individual's body was not present in the trial, it would also be inappropriate to try a person if their mind wasn't present at the trial. That was formalized over the centuries in American law until in 1960 the Supreme Court, in a case called Dusky versus United States, said that a state, essentially the case, court said a state couldn't prosecute someone if the individual didn't have sufficient present ability to consult with their lawyer with a reasonable degree of rational understanding and had a rational as well as factual understanding of the proceedings against him. The issue of competency has been defined a little bit since then in state decisions, but in the 1980s, it began to be used more and more in juvenile defenses. And in the 90s, when the mantra was, if a child can do the crime, they should be able to do the time, and laws became much more severe, the issue of raising the prospect of a juvenile's competency or incompetency became more strategically popular for defense attorneys who were defending juveniles. One thing to say in clarification on that is people oftentimes confuse the issue of competency with the issue of sanity. Sanity has to do with the state of mind of a person at the moment that they committed an act that would be considered a crime. Competency has to do with the state of the mind of a person at the moment that a trial is supposed to begin, or in a juvenile case, a juvenile adjudication, a hearing would begin. If a child can't participate in their own defense and communicate with their attorney, that child, a court would be obligated to do a competency evaluation. It's become more and more of an issue because, as I said, the issue of juvenile justice has become much more complex in the last 20 years in each state in our nation. The Supreme Court's ruling in Dusky versus United States applies to juveniles whether or not states have a statute that defines competency. And in the last few years, more and more states have decided to define competency rather than simply rely on the courts to do it.
I would just add a few minor things to that. As Doug said, kids have really had the ability to, or the right, constitutional right to be competent to stand trial since 1967 in Galt, but it wasn't really raised until the 1990s because the feeling was that the rehabilitative ideals of the juvenile court were enough to protect juveniles. And so we really didn't need these other rigid procedures to protect them. But in the 90s, we start to see this Get Tough legislation that was referenced, and more kids were being transferred to adult court at younger ages for more offenses. And so in response, the defense bar began to raise the issue of competence to stand trial in juvenile court in order to provide better protection for their clients. But if you think about it, the reasons behind having competence to stand trial in adult criminal courts apply really no less in juvenile courts. We want to protect due process rights of youth just as much as we do for adults. And without competence to stand trial, those rights really are not well protected. In fact, some would argue that they become meaningless unless the juvenile is competent to stand trial. So, for example, how is someone going to assist counsel if they don't really know what's going on in the proceeding, or how are they going to avoid incriminating themselves if they don't understand the proceedings against them, or how are they going to confront witnesses if they don't really know what's going on? So it's really this idea that we want to protect the accuracy of the adjudication, we want to protect the dignity of the process, and we want the system to be fair, but also appear fair. So, at first, when this issue became raised in the 1990s, at first, adult standards were often just drawn down and applied to juvenile courts. But then research started to show that there were some important differences between kids and adults, and that perhaps the adult standards weren't really appropriate for competence to stand trial with regard to youth.
Great, thank you. I don't know, Anne, did you want to add anything to that?
No, I think that was great.
Okay. So juvenile competency laws typically direct how the issue of competency is to be raised and evaluated. What are some of the competency-related abilities that we would even examine for youth? And, Kim, you had started talking about the research. What does the research say more about those things?
Well, generally, when we go to do an evaluation as a clinician, my previous history is as a clinical forensic evaluator. So when I think about evaluating competence to stand trial, generally we break it down into three basic prongs. So those would be factual understanding, rational understanding, and also the ability to consult with counsel. So factual understanding is things like, what does the judge do? What does the jury do? What's the defense attorney's role? Rational understanding is also sometimes called appreciation, and that really involves the individual's ability to apply that information in a way that's not impaired by, for example, mental illness. So, for example, a person could understand that their defense attorney is on their side, but they could hold what we would call in mental health a delusion or a false fixed belief that the government is actually conspiring against them. So in that case, it's their mental illness that would be interfering with their rational understanding, and they wouldn't be able to meet the Dusky standard. And the third prong is consult with counsel. And essentially, this gets at the idea that we want defendants to be able to communicate with their attorney to tell them what happened, to be able to mount a defense, and also things like, can they comport their behavior to what's expected within the courtroom setting. So, if you'd like, I could talk a little bit more about how we go ahead and apply those concepts and how we think about them differently with adults and juveniles.
Maybe as we sort of discuss this later on and how it plays out in courts, that might be a great time to talk about that. I'm just wondering, though, if there's anything we need to add here really about the difference when we were talking about immaturity, developmental immaturity, and how that may play into age presumptions. But I'll leave that all to you to decide. Is there anything you want to add about that now?
Yeah.
I don't want to hog the microphone. I will say, first of all, that all but one or two states have stated that the issue of immaturity may not specifically be a determinative criteria as to whether or not a child is competent. This is usually because, of course, children are generally seen to be practically and legally immature in a number of ways. Many states simply rely on the Dusky criteria and leave it to the courts to figure out how to apply the two prongs of the Dusky criteria to juveniles. Other states will start to map out specifically, the Dusky criteria have to be met because of a developmental disability or because of a mental illness. In Ohio, we said a child lacks the developmental capacity because, again, the legislature didn't want to use the term immature to determine whether or not a child was incompetent. I'll concede the mic at this point.
I guess I would just add to that, when we think about developmental immaturity, I'm not sure if listeners will have a good conceptualization from reading the research about what that comprises. So if you'd like, I could define that a little bit and help folks understand what we mean
that would be
by
great.
Developmental immaturity.
Because a lot of people, I know four of us have a legal background, but I think a lot of people listening in don't. So if you can explain it for even general public, that'd be wonderful.
Sure. So I think one of the things that trips people up is that when you think about kids, the research shows are about as smart as they're going to be by about age 15. And so the question that raises is, well, then why do you hear, for example, parents say, what were you thinking, right? And so we really need to have to take a closer look, because it's not just intelligence that goes into one's ability to make decisions, which is very relevant for one's competence to stand trial. So when we do take that closer look, what do we see? And we see three types of convergent evidence, which for scientists is great, because we think that even more strongly indicates that something is true. And so those types of evidence are fMRI research, behavioral research, and then research that's been done specifically in the context of competence to stand trial. And this research actually, incidentally, has been even cited by the Supreme Court recently, and you may be familiar with Graham, Jackson, Miller, all of these cases. You see a lot of this psychosocial research being incorporated into that. But so what does this research tell us overall? So what's this convergence of evidence? So it tells us a couple things about kids and how they're different from adults. They differ on their future orientation. They differ on their risk perception. They differ on their impulsivity or their ability to delay their actions. They're different in that they're more influenced by their peers. And they're also more suggestible and compliant, especially when it comes to authority figures. And all of these tend to be relevant to competence to stand trial. So psychosocial immaturity is, when we say psychosocial immaturity or developmental immaturity, those are the concepts we're really talking about. And those are really continuing to develop even into early adulthood up to, say, age 25, long after adolescents have at 15 become sort of as smart as they're going to be, right? So overall, youth are essentially, they're less able to control their impulses. They're more driven by the thrill of rewards. They're more short-sighted. They're more oriented towards immediate gratification. And they're less able to resist pressure from peers and also other important figures in their life or authority figures in their life.
Great. Thank you.
Sure.
And at NCSL published
I'm
a
sorry,
post...
Lauren, can I
yep.
interrupt you? I need to correct myself here just because I think during my comments I said that Ohio had added a clause that said a child could be found incompetent due to lack of developmental capacity. In fact, the word was mental capacity. The legislature was very specific on that, so I just wanted to make that clear.
Sure. And sort of, you know, again, a segue, and to a postcard that was published by NCSL, who's looking across the states of what is happening with competency laws. What are some of those trends and maybe some changes that you see happening that we should know about?
Thank you, Lauren. I'd say about during the past decade, juvenile competency has really come to the forefront as policymakers are digesting the research that researchers are providing on adolescent development and their emotional and psychological immaturity or maturity. And the states are looking at their laws and they're expanding procedural protections by making developmental immaturity a factor in findings of competency to stand trial. Now, not all states have competency laws, so absent any statutory direction, courts in some states do recognize and review juveniles for competence. For example, in Vermont, it has language in their court rules that says that age and developmental maturity of the child shall be considered in determining competency in a criminal proceeding. So about 5 years ago or so, there was only about 10 states that had juvenile competency statutes, and today we have at least 20 states that have enacted some sort of competency laws. Michigan's law went into effect of March of 2013, and South Dakota just passed a law in June of 2013. So the passage of these laws is definitely a legislative trend.
I just wanted to add to that a little bit more. I mean, I actually joined this effort not until 2008, and I would say, I mean, considering that the speed of legislation is sometimes not that fast, it's actually a pretty, at least in my opinion, I'd be curious to hear other people's opinions. Oh, this is Kim, by the way. I was actually counting before we got on the air, but we've had, since I've come on board, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 states that have had legislation, and I know there are at least 3 other states that are considering legislation. So taking into account the amount of time that it usually takes for legislation to get passed, and the fact that states like Michigan, who was recently successful, had been stuck for a decade. I think that it's a fast-moving trend. I would characterize it as a relatively fast-moving trend. I'd be curious to hear Anne's thoughts on that.
I would absolutely agree with you, Kim. There seems to be some momentum in, like I said, in the past 5 or so years, there has, you know, the number has doubled, and I think it's because new research and information is coming out every year about youth immaturity and developmental maturity, and I think that legislators are able to take that information and make some decisions on how they want to craft their statutes.
I would also say that there's usually a public policy issue at hand as well. There's usually one or two times a year an unfortunate situation where a very young child has committed a rather extreme crime, and there's a lot of public debate then about what should happen if there's a child who's still in elementary school who murders another child or even an adult, or if a child has been very, very reckless with an automobile or a piece of machinery and injures people in that respect. There's a strong debate. As you had pointed out, I led the professionals who were arguing and trying to come to a compromise in Ohio's legislature. There's a strong debate in a polarized field of people who want to really defend the innocence of children, regardless of how the children are behaving, and children who want to defend the public and make sure that anybody is punished for a crime regardless of their age. Those kinds of things, when some big event happens, it generally spawns legislatures into taking a look at things. I think the legislatures may sometimes become more dismayed than resolved by looking at the research that's out there.
Well, and as you said, Doug, I mean, it's usually some like big tragic event that calls upon action. But we're talking about standards that are applied across the board. We have very young kids or kids of any age coming in for even minor acts and where this could be applied. And you mentioned Ohio. I think this is a great time to sort of turn to the Ohio experience. We passed a competency law here that went into effect at the end of September 2011. And so not to get into the particulars of the statute, but really want to hear the process for those who are listening in from other states. So what was there something that happened here in Ohio? I think we were also a state. It sounded, you know, that someone mentioned that maybe a state was stalled, like Michigan, and then got going, and that kind of sounds like Ohio. If you can kind of take us through that and sort of any lessons learned that you want to share.
Well, sure. Ohio began to discuss this in the late 1990s when there was a lot of talk about juvenile reform. As has happened in many states, Ohio passed a number of laws that criminalized behavior that hadn't been criminalized before for juveniles, and then Ohio became overwhelmed with the number of kids that needed to be adjudicated and then sanctioned. Where were they going to be placed if they were actually to go into some kind of an incarceratory program? Fast forward a few years, what kind of really happened was we had a Supreme Court justice, Evelyn Stratton, who became kind of a champion of mental illness and the developmental issues of kids and veterans and other people who might have special needs that would come attention to the court as much as it would come to the attention of a mental health center. She asked a group of people to start to study the issue of juvenile competency in the 2000s. The committee came up with a couple of recommendations that just weren't going to be economically feasible at the time. But the issue wasn't forgotten, and when I came on board in 2008, working for the state of Ohio for about a year and a half, that became one of the issues that I was assigned to work hard on. There were people who were concerned about how was Ohio treating juveniles who might need treatment as much as punishment, and then there were people concerned about how much punishment was fair to give out to a juvenile who had done something inappropriate. The time was ripe just to come up with some legislation that could be passed.
You know, I just wanted to add, Doug, that Justice Stratton, this is Ann Teagan, Justice Stratton has been a speaker at one of our conferences and has spoken to a legislative audience, and her information was very, very good and informative. So
I'm going to remind our listeners that they can ask questions in the chat room or call 347-994-1149 and push the number 1 on their keypad. We do have a question. If any of you can give some examples of how competency would come up in cases, just so that maybe our listeners would better understand, maybe there's a well-known case if this has come up, or since we're really also talking more on a legislative sort of statutory level, if there's any sort of example that you think that's been in the news about the process or any of the controversy and challenges around this. But I think just to help our listener wants to know, you know, if you can sort of put a story and some facts behind this for them.
I'm happy to answer either of those. I feel like Doug maybe has this is Kim Larson. I feel like Doug maybe has the sort of boots on the ground approach in that.
Why don't you start, Kim, and then Doug can fill in, add some stuff.
Sure.
Okay. What I've been finding is that, and if I'm understanding the question correctly, and feel free to redirect me if I'm misinterpreting the question, but it is that. So how do these efforts get off the ground in different states?
Well, I'm sort of added that. I think the person was looking more for actually concrete examples of cases where competency would be raised and how and what under what circumstances.
Oh, okay. Well, so when a kid comes to court and they meet with, say, their attorney or the judge sees them, and there are often clinical indications of the fact that this kid may not be competent to stand trial. And at that point, the judge or the judge sua sponte or by their own motion or the defense attorney, most likely sometimes the prosecution, will raise the issue of competence to stand trial. And then at that point, there's a hearing and an expert is brought in. And the expert will evaluate the youth to provide an opinion about whether the youth is competent to stand trial. After that, and I'm kind of painting with broad strokes here, but the the hearing is held. Sometimes it's waived because the parties agree. If the kid is found competent, then the trial proceeds. However, if they're incompetent, then everything comes to a halt until that youth can be restored to competence or remediated to competence. And I'll talk a little bit later about how the interchangeability of those two terms. If the kid is then sent for restoration or remediation services aimed at hopefully the specific deficits that are underlying the reason for a finding of incompetence, and if the youth is able to be restored to competence, then they return and the trial process proceeds.
Okay.
If they're unrestorable, then that's a different situation, and I think maybe we'll leave that for later when we talk about some of the more complicated issues that arise, mm-hmm. unless you'd like to talk about it now.
No. Doug, if you want to add anything, I know for our listeners it's
sure.
really helpful to actually hear about real-life examples. So
sure.
if you
and that,
maybe can add that aspect.
Sure. I will go back to my opening comment where the issue of competency has to do with the state of mind that a juvenile would be in at the moment that a hearing or a trial is supposed to start. So in terms of how would the issue of competency play in a trial or in a hearing, technically it wouldn't, because if a child isn't competent, then the hearing or the trial isn't going to go forward. Some examples I will give you. A few years ago here in Ohio, we had a sad situation where a boy who had just a number of diagnoses, he was only 13 years old, He wasn't able to communicate. He was not able to go into any kind of public school. He managed, however, to steal a bread truck in one of the cities around Columbus and roared through the streets, had caused an accident and killed a person and injured a couple of others. Well, as I said, he wasn't able to communicate. He had a bunch of diagnoses. He took a handful of pills every morning to get him started. I don't mean that in a pejorative way. He was prescribed a number of pills. And the fact of the matter is, this is someone who unfortunately just hadn't been monitored the right way. That's how he was able to get away and then get into the bread truck. And he had the assumption was, because nobody was able to really talk with him about this, the assumption was he had seen other people, seen the motions that other people went through when they drove, and he was able to imitate that. That child was found to be not competent. That child was found to be incapable of being brought to competency. So that child was placed in a residential facility until his 18th birthday, at which point he'll be reevaluated for under civil rules for more needs later on. Now, I've been asked to evaluate some kids where the kids are quite communicative. And again, there are some kids who are just young or who are just immature, and they're scared, but that doesn't make them incompetent. I've dealt with some kids who didn't understand what the definition of sex was, even though they had been charged with a sex offense. I've worked with kids who, a child who couldn't remember things, a child who had a developmental disability that made it impossible for them to be able to process information. They could sing their ABCs, or they might be able to count up to 20 or something like that, and they'd be able to use one or two syllable words. But once you began to talk about the concept of accepting a plea to a reduced charge, well, there the child just couldn't understand that at all, and there would have to be another evaluation to determine whether or not the child could be brought to competency or not. We had another situation. We've had some recent shocking situations in Ohio, not too far from Columbus again, where I think the boy was 13 at the time, was trying to stop an argument between his mother and his mother's boyfriend and ended up shooting the boyfriend. That child was given a number of competency evaluations because of just his age alone made people concerned that he wasn't competent. And then up in northern Ohio, we had a situation where a boy who had been in an argument with his mother, shot and killed his mother with a gun. And again, the youth was so young that there was some concern that he might not be competent. I can tell you the first boy who shot the mother's boyfriend was found to be competent. I'm afraid I can't remember the second boy, the outcome. But more recently, we had the situation in Chardon, Ohio, where the high school student shot and killed three classmates. He was determined to be competent. They ran a competency evaluation on him. He was, I can't remember if he was 16 or 17, but he was well advanced into his teen years. But the issue was whether or not he'd be able to participate in his defense, and he was. There were other issues going on with him for sure, but he was still competent. And that's.
Thank you.
I hope those.
That was great.
Those
yes, those, I think so.
Okay.
Yeah. No, I think that really, that really was very helpful.
I'll add one last comment on that.
Sure.
The issue of the existence of a mental illness, mental retardation, or developmental disability has been determined by courts not to be the sole determiner. You can't say that just because a person has mental retardation that they also are incompetent. There really does have to be an evaluation, as Kim was saying, to determine the scope of a child's ability to understand the process of the hearing and their ability to participate in their defense.
I think that's an important point that Doug raises. That's often a misconception when people are going to begin the process of creating legislation, in that they often think that just because a youth has a diagnosis of a mental illness, or they think just because a youth has an intellectual disability, or just because they're developmentally immature, that automatically equals them not being competent to stand trial. That's one of the things that I've come across over and over again as a misconception. And in fact, a kid could be all three of those, some combination of those, one of those, and we really need to be looking at what are their functional abilities, what can they actually do and can't do. before we make a determination about the legal issue of whether they're competent or not. So just because someone is mentally ill, intellectually disabled, or developmentally immature does not mean that they're incompetent to stand trial. And there's a lot of confusion out there about that.
So that's a great segue into sort of talking about key recommendations for states and legislators who are either working on drafting a new statute or amending a current one that they already have. What are some things they should be considering? What are some things you've all seen? Some definite provisions that you would recommend be there? So I don't know who wants to start us off.
I'm happy to start or whatever Doug's more comfortable with. I think we could divide that maybe into two pieces. One is the, as I see it, is the more practical day-to-day advice that I've actually learned a ton from Doug about this, about how legislation actually gets created and what are the practical things you need to take into consideration. And then as far as recommendations, key recommendations, when you're going to write legislation from a more theoretical perspective, perhaps I could take that piece, just because we wrote that legislative guide, which is free on the internet, and I think you put up on your website.
And Anne may have some stuff that she'd like to add to working with the state legislature.
Oh, yeah.
So
sorry.
Why don't we start with some, I mean, Anne, or you can start with some, like, the general recommendations that both you have, you know, either from the manual, the guide, or Anne, from your perspective of, you know, working with the states as well.
Okay, well, I would just add quickly that when states are considering amending their competency statutes, a lot of it has to do with definitions and really defining what they're talking about, if that's mental illness or also another thing that they look at is specifying who the experts might be that will be evaluating the use or the specific criteria involved. Those are the three main things that states are looking at when they're amending their statutes.
All right. So, Kim, in the guide, I think there is some specifics around those issues, if you want to sort of take it from there on some recommendations.
Yeah, I mean, we actually go through sort of two preliminary issues and then 16 what we see as key recommendations that if you're going to start drafting one of these laws, we think they're the most important issues that you need to consider. And we provide the pros and cons of doing it each way. We tried to actually resist giving a recommendation because we wanted states to think through it for themselves and not just take our recommendation. But we did end up putting in recommendations at the end. So, but maybe I could just highlight a few of those and talk about what I see as the most controversial of those issues over the past 5 years as I've worked with different states.
Okay.
So I think probably the most controversial is, as we've talked about a little bit, is this idea of developmental immaturity. And states, some states actually are completely in agreement, and I found this to not be an issue at all. And in some states, I found this to be a very contentious issue about whether the parents patriae or rehabilitative ideals of the court already incorporate that idea of developmental immaturity versus states that think developmental immaturity, for example, should be explicitly enumerated in their statute just to ensure that judges have clear guidance about the fact that they can consider developmental immaturity as an underlying reason for a finding of incompetence. And it also gives guidance to clinicians, I think, as well, who are performing these evaluations. It also leads, I think, by putting it into a lot more evenness. I know that even here in Massachusetts, we had from one court to the next for a while. That's since been remediated. But, you know, you might get one judge who accepts developmental immaturity as a basis, and then in the next courtroom over, a judge who doesn't. And so you could have very disparate outcomes on that, which could be concerning. I think another contentious issue is the level of ability required to meet the DUSCY standard. So some have argued that because there's this rehabilitative ideal, and some people think that kids have less at stake in juvenile court, that there should be a lower level of ability to meet the DUSCY test as compared to in adult court. On the other side, I think people argue that DUSCY comes part and parcel with all of the things that went along with that case law, and so you can't really sever the two. We came down on the side of, or at least I, there were some reasonable minds may differ, but there was some contention about my research team, but I think we came down on the side of thinking that really the same level of ability to be fair to kids should be required. We also thought providing counsel before and after the competence evaluation was important, and that's also related to protecting them against self-incrimination for information that they might reveal during the competence evaluation. Kids are more impulsive, they're more likely to just say things, and so I think it's important that we consider providing some protection for those evaluations and statements made during those evaluations. Also, the qualifications of the examiner. And this can be a little bit more complicated depending on the time, the type of state you're in, if it's more rural or more urban. But I think the key points there are that you should really be looking for something higher than licensure. You should be looking for juvenile experience in your evaluators and also forensic experience in your evaluators. You don't want to set the criteria too stringent, and I think that, you know, states need to be aware of their own resources when they're writing their legislation. You know, if you set the bar too high, you may end up with only 3 people that can conduct your evaluations, when that could really be remedied by, for example, finding juvenile-trained people and then teaching them the forensic piece through a CE, for example. I think it's also important to
and
think
when
about,
you say CE, I know you're saying cuts. Do you want to?
Oh, yeah. No. So ongoing continuing education. So psychologists and psychiatrists, even attorneys, are required medical doctors from year to year to attend a certain number of hours to sort of keep them up with the field. So that would be continuing education or CEs. I think it's also important that we think about how we're conducting these evaluations with regard to kids and the settings that we're doing it in, which should be very different from how we're providing either evaluations or remediation services to youth. Research has found that the least restrictive setting possible is really the best thing for the youth in the juvenile justice system. And so we really want to put an emphasis on that when we're creating legislation, in that we want to let people know that they really should be thinking through, does this kid need a high level of security or do they not? Also, remediation services specifically targeting at the reason why the youth was found incompetent. If somebody is incompetent due to mental illness, they're more likely to need psychiatric intervention, whereas somebody with an intellectual disability or somebody that is incompetent just to develop mental immaturity is going to need a more psychoeducationally based service.
Okay.
I don't know if other people wanted to add to that. I have a few more, but we could come back to them in a bit.
Doug, is there anything you wanted to add,
Anne? I think those are great recommendations. I'm looking at research that I had done in terms of what actually were states using for criteria. And overwhelmingly, the states tend to just incorporate somehow the two prongs of the DUSCY decision, whether the defendant has a rational and factual understanding of the criminal proceedings and can rationally assist in their defense as one of the criteria. The second most often used criteria in state legislations these days is whether or not there's a diagnosis of a mental condition which rendered the defendant incompetent based upon the competency, the DUSCY criteria. after that, in descending order, issues such as whether or not the defendant could understand the range of penalties that could be imposed, whether or not the defendant can actually communicate with counsel, and then whether or not the defendant understands the roles that each member in the courtroom is playing. What does a judge do? What does an attorney do? What does defense counsel do? What does a prosecutor do? It goes on down. A few states have been ambitious enough to include a lot of criteria in their laws, but I will say, from a legal standpoint, it's always going to come down to the Dusky criteria. And I will say also that I don't know if you want to go this direction yet, but in my experience and the experience of other states that I spoke with, judges start to get very nervous when the legislature begins to tell them how to practice. So there's oftentimes pushback from the judiciary from being told what to do. The judge doesn't want to know how they're supposed to rule on a case before they start to hear it. And so the judges will probably want to keep as much ability to interpret as possible when criteria for competency are being considered or proffered by the legislature.
No, I definitely think turning to challenges and how you overcome its time. We have only about 15 minutes left, and I know they probably went hand in hand with some of the recommendations as well to see what states have struggled with, what may have been missed. So I don't know who, if you have others you want to sort of add right now, Doug, of challenges that you faced, or Kim
well,
and Ann, if
you know,
go on.
I will tell you, in Ohio, there were really three camps. There were child advocates, there were the prosecutor's side, and then there were the judges. And again, I hope I don't sound like I'm using any kind of a pejorative term in any one of those camps, but it really took a lot of work and willingness to compromise on all three parts. The child advocates had to acknowledge that there were, in fact, going to be some kids who were appropriately to be adjudicated as delinquents because of what happened. And the prosecutors were, they did concede that they're just, it wasn't going to be constitutional to try some kids anyway, so we might as well define how is Ohio going to view that aspect of due process. And again, I worked a lot with the judges to make sure that they didn't feel like their hands were going to be tied in deciding not only what would be the criteria of competency, but even some of the timelines. At one point, there was it might have taken as long as 4.5 years in Ohio to determine whether or not a juvenile was competent. That just didn't seem fair in a number of ways. But I worked with the judges to talk about for them to weigh in what would be realistic timelines to just to consider whether or not there should be a competency hearing, and then how much time should the clinicians have to weigh in on an opinion, how much weight should the opinion be given as opposed to the judge's ability to decide. And then, as Kim was saying, Ohio does have a provision that would allow children to be brought to competency if they're seen as incompetent yet attainable. And even then there's a deadline on that. And again, the child advocates wanted and received some consideration for, there's one set of deadlines if a child is in a program due to their act of delinquency, and another set of deadlines if a child is living at home and awaiting a second competency determination. It took a lot of communication, had to massage a lot of egos and a lot philosophical ideals to get the law together, but it did come together and it passed the first time we submitted it.
Doug, and I know that I've heard a lot of, I think, Anne, is that you? I just wanted to say, like, some of the things that we've heard is resistance based on cost, but it's also, this really requires competence across the board, not only of the courts and the judges, but the attorneys to understand what's going on, the mental health professionals to do, to do an adequate, a great job of evaluation, and then also the programming that you're talking about for kids who have been ruled as incompetent. So those are all these different pushbacks that happen. And I'm sorry, Anne.
Oh yes, I was just going to mention and agree with Doug that the same experiences that Ohio had was also debated in Florida this year. There was a bill that both houses did pass, and that would have shortened the time frame for criminal charges to be dismissed against juvenile defendants from 5 years to 3 years, and the governor did veto it. So the same timelines of the remediation and things like that are one of the big challenges that people are arguing about.
And I'll say also, if I can, I just reminded myself of this, one of the biggest concerns that kept coming up was a fear that once competency became well known to the public, that everybody was going to be claiming that the kids were incompetent, and the juvenile prosecutors were very concerned that they wouldn't ever be able to prosecute anybody because of issues that would be raised around competency. So we put safeguards into the law that wouldn't allow raising the issue of competency to be a merely strategic effort by a defense counsel. There truly had to be a good reason to raise the issue of competency. Furthermore, research that I did in a number of states, everybody had the same concern and everybody had the same experience. Once the issue of competency was legislated, or the definition of competency, once that was legislated, no state seems to have seen an increase in the number of competency requests or competency determinations. There might be a spike for the first few months after the legislation passes because it's seen as new and novel. But Ohio's experience, again, seems to be that of other states. Before we had a competency definition for juveniles, we had less than 5% of the kids who were being brought into juvenile court were raising the issue of competency, and then even such a small number would be considered decimal dust of the kids who were actually found not to be competent, and even a smaller number of kids were found to be not competent and not attainable, couldn't attain competency. Other states have consistently told me, or consistently did when I was working on this, that was their experience as well. You're not going to create a new defense and a new population of scary kids just because you define competency in your state.
Yeah, I think Doug raises an interesting overarching theme maybe, and that's that if you're thinking about starting this type of legislation, I find that education up front will go a long way down the road.
Oh, yeah.
So dispelling people of these sort of common misperceptions that, you know, just because someone is mentally ill, IDDI, means that they're incompetent to stand trial, or that kids can't be brought to competence most of the time, or that it's going to be really expensive, or, you know, that all of the axe murderers are getting off scot-free, or, you know, and the key, I think, is data collection and coming in with an informed perspective. My first goal in any state that I work with is to learn the system and to find out where those misconceptions are, because I feel like it saves a lot of time down the road. So for anybody out there that's thinking of going this route and starting an effort in their state, I would encourage them to do what Doug did, which is collect very detailed data about how things work and getting numbers. Because I know in one state that I worked with, they figured out that people thought it was going to be this huge deal, and in the end, it ended up being they were really talking about 70 kids, most of whom were already in the community mental health system and being paid for, and so the cost ended up being pretty nominal. But unless you collect that data and really find out, you know, it's hard to counter those types of arguments.
You know, Kim, this is Ann. I would have to agree with you on that. In Michigan's fiscal impact statement in their bill, it said that it would have an indeterminate fiscal impact on the judiciary. And I think that those words can be kind of scary for people who are looking at fiscal impact statements. But it really is just to the extent that the implementation of the standards might increase evaluations, or it may increase caseloads to court-appointed health examiners, things like that. But when a indeterminate fiscal impact statement comes out on paper, it can be kind of scary at first.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I would encourage people to get creative also about how they're coming up with their numbers, because not all states track cost data, But, you know, some states have been able to use uniform crime reports or sort of back into the numbers in different ways. So that's, you know, something to keep in mind when you're approaching trying to collect cost data. Also, one thing we're doing here at UMass over the next year is going to be collecting that type of cost data. And obviously, I'm funded by MacArthur, so people are entitled to give me a call, and I'll help them as best I can. I mean, I know that in one case, six states were surveyed, and they didn't see a significant rise even in the number of competence requests. And then one state, looking at just the rural courts, it hadn't actually ever been raised. And Doug points out the reason why, and that's because the standard is still for good cause, and attorneys have to make a showing. So that still functions as a protection from, you know, this increase in evaluations that some people might be afraid of.
Correct.
And I would say if someone is wanting to try and promote new legislation or a revision of legislation, work very hard to find a judge who will help champion the cause as much as they can, being part of the judiciary. One of the things that I heard many times from our judiciary was, look, this is a constitutional issue. The Supreme Court has already said that we have to do it. So technically, the cost for evaluations and things like that should have been built into a county's or a state's budget, since the issue of juvenile competency is an issue of due process. It's already there. Again, raising the issue through proposed legislation brings it to everybody's attention, but you can't just create a new sense of how to do law, bypassing legislation that includes definitions.
We have 3 minutes left.
Okay.
So
oh, wow.
I get See, everyone's always worried that, you know, there won't be enough to say. So we're really at sort of final thoughts at this point, and I'd like to hear from each of you. And since you were ready to jump in, you want to start?
Yeah, great. My final thoughts is that, you know, NCSL has published a Trends in Juvenile Justice State Legislation, and it was trends in the last 10 years, and juvenile competency was one of the 7 big trends that we've seen in the last 10 years that legislatures have been dealing with. And so it's a very timely issue, and I expect to see more legislation coming out in the next couple of years.
Great. Kim or Doug?
Yeah, sure. No, I'll go ahead. And I will just let people know that through my MacArthur Foundation grant, I actually am able to provide some limited technical assistance. So if there are folks out there thinking about legislation that would like assistance, be it research, background, suggestions of things to read, or pointing them in the right direction, introducing them to people, things like that, I'm happy to help, and I'm happy to have you put my email up on the website. And I also could provide, possibly for the website, a few resources for folks who are looking to educate themselves better about some of these issues. But I just want to reiterate that I think it's important that we continue to protect the due process rights of juveniles. I know that we didn't get into this as much, but the services are somewhat lagging behind. There are a few models out there, but they definitely have their pluses and minuses. I'm happy to talk to people about that as well. But despite the lack in services, I think it's important that we continue to raise the issue.
Thank you. Doug?
And I will say that Ann and Kim have raised some excellent opportunities for resources. Anybody who wants to try and promote competency legislation in their area or their state should use numbers as much as possible. What's going to sell the legislation is a reassurance that it's not going to cost money, a lot of money to do so. What's going to sell it to the judges is that it's not going to give them more work than they would already have to do. And for any attorneys out there who are wanting to try and raise the issue of a juvenile's competency, keep in mind it doesn't happen very often. Any attorney who's going to do that is probably going to be a trailblazer in their own community. So be creative and stick to what the law says you're supposed to do.
Great. And some of the resources that were mentioned are up on Children's Law Center's website. If you want to check that out, it's childrenslawky.org. Also, there's the MacArthur Foundation, Models for Change, which is modelsforchange.net, the National Youth Screening and Assessment Project, NYSAP.us, and the National Conference of State Legislatures is NCSL.org. Doug, Ann, and Kim, thank you so much for participating today. It was wonderful.
You're very welcome.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you.
Our next show will examine what's happening in the juvenile justice as it pertains to American Indian and Alaska Native youth, including effective programs, policies, and strategies for tribal youth engagement and intervention of delinquency. So to stay informed about upcoming shows, you can follow us here at Blog Talk Radio or visit the Children's Law Center's website. Take care and see you next time on Spotlight and Youth. Goodbye, everybody.